This is a reading of The Threefold Social Order by Rudolf Steiner. This is Chapter 3, Capitalism and Creative Social Ideas, Capital and Human Labor. The only way to get a sound judgment as to what action is needed in the social field is through insight into the basic forces at work in the social organism. The basic idea behind the preceding chapters was an attempt to arrive at such an insight. The facts of social life show that the social disturbances are not merely on the surface, but are fundamental. Vision that penetrates to the foundations is needed to cope with them. It is in capital and capitalism that the worker looks for the cause of his grievances. But to arrive at any fruitful conclusion as to capital's part, for good or ill, in the social structure, one has first to be perfectly clear as to how capital is produced and consumed. One has to learn how this process takes place as a result of the individual abilities of people and the effects of the rights system and the forces of economic life. One points to human labor as the factor that, together with capital and the nature basis of the economy, creates the economic values. Through these three factors, the worker becomes conscious of his social situation. To reach any conclusion as to the way in which human labor must be placed into the social organism without injuring the worker's self-respect requires keeping in mind the relation of human labor to the development of individual abilities and to the rights consciousness. Today, quite rightly, people are asking what the first step must be, the most immediate action, if the claims presented by the social movement are to be met. Even a first step will not succeed unless we first know how it is to be related to the basic principles of a healthy social order. Once this is known, then in whatever part of the social structure one is working, one will discover the particular thing that requires doing. What keeps people from this insight is the fact that they take their opinions from the social institutions themselves. Their thoughts follow the lead of the facts instead of mastering them. Today, however, we need to see that no adequate judgment can be formed without going back to those primal creative thoughts that underlie all social institutions. The body social requires a constant fresh supply of the forces residing in these primal thoughts. If the suitable channels for these thoughts are not there, then social institutions take on forms that impede life instead of furthering it. Yet the primal thoughts live on in men's instinctive impulses, even if their conscious thoughts are mistaken and build up stumbling blocks. It is these primal thoughts that come to expression, openly or in a hidden way, in the revolutionary convulsions of the social order. Such convulsions will only cease when the body social takes a form in which two things are possible. First, an inclination to notice when an institution is beginning to deviate from its original intention, and second, the counteracting of every such deviation before it becomes strong enough to be a danger. In our times, the actual conditions have come to deviate widely from the demand of the primal thoughts. We need to turn vigorously back to these primal thoughts and not dismiss them as impractical generalities. From them we need to learn the direction in which the actual realities must now be consciously guided, for the time has gone by in which the old instinctive guidance sufficed for mankind. One of the basic questions raised by the practical criticism of the times is how to put a stop to the oppression the worker suffers under private capitalism. The owner or manager of capital is in a position to put other men's bodily labor into the service of what he undertakes to produce. it is necessary to distinguish three elements in the social relation that arises in the cooperation of capital and human labor power. First, there is the enterprising activity, which must rest on the individual ability of some person or group of persons. Second, the relation of the entrepreneur to the worker, which must be a relation in right. Third is the production of an object, which acquires a commodity value in the circuit of economic life. For the enterprising activity to come to expression in a healthy way, there must be forces at work in social life that let individual abilities function in the best possible way. This can only happen if the body social includes a sphere that gives an able person the freedom to use his capacities and leaves the judgment of their value to the free and voluntary understanding of others. It is clear that what a man can do socially by means of capital comes into the sphere of society where the laws and the administration are taken care of by the spiritual life. If the political state interferes to influence these personal activities, the decisions will unavoidably show a lack of understanding of individual abilities. This is because the political state is necessarily based on what is similar and equal in all men's claims on life. It is its business to translate this equality into practice. Within its own domain, it must make sure that every man has a fair chance to make his personal opinion count. Its proper work has nothing to do with understanding individual abilities, so it ought never to have any influence on the exercise of these. Just as little, where capital is needed for something, should the prospect of economic advantage determine the exercise of individual abilities. Many, weighing the pros and cons of capitalism, put great stress on this prospect. In their opinion, it is only this incentive that can induce individual ability to exert itself. As quote-unquote practical men, they refer to the imperfections of human nature. There is no doubt that in the social order under which the present state of things developed, the prospect of economic advantage has come to play a very important part. The fact is that to no small extent, this is the cause of the state of things today. Thus, there is need for the development of some other different incentive. This can only be found in the social sense that will develop out of a healthy spiritual life. Out of the strength of the free spiritual life, a man's education and schooling will send him into activity equipped with impulses that will lead him, thanks to this social sense, to making real the things toward which his individual capacities drive him. Visionary illusions have certainly caused tremendous harm in social endeavor, as in other fields. But such a point of view as that expressed above, need not come into the quote-unquote visionary category. What is stated here does not rest on any notion that the spirit will work wonders if only the people who think they are filled with it continually speak about it. It comes, on the contrary, out of the observation of how people actually do work when they work together freely in the spiritual field. This work in common takes on a social character of its own accord, provided only that it can develop in real freedom. It is only the lack of freedom in spiritual life that has kept its social character from coming to expression. The spiritual forces of social life have come to expression among the leading classes in a way that has, antisocially, restricted their use and value to limited circles. What was produced in these circles could only be brought to the workers in an artificial way. They could get from it no support for their souls, because they did not really have any part in it. Schemes for popular education, for, quote, uplifting the masses, unquote, to appreciation of art, etc., are no way of spreading spiritual property among, quote, the people, unquote, for, quote, the people, unquote, are not within its life. All that can be given them is a view of these treasures from a point outside. This also applies to those offshoots of spiritual activity that find their way into economic life on the basis of capital. In a healthy social order, the worker should not merely stand at his machine while the capitalist alone knows what is going to become of the products in the circuit of economic life. The worker should be able to form a conception of the part he is playing in society through his work on the production line. Conferences, regarded as much a part of the operation as the work itself, should be held regularly by the management. Their aim will be the developing of a common set of ideas for the employed and the employer. Such activity will bring the workers to a sense of the fact that control of capital, properly carried out, benefits the whole community, including the worker. Also, an approach aimed at promoting a full understanding will make the employer careful to keep his business methods above suspicion. Only those unable to appreciate the effects of the community of feeling that arises from sharing a common task will consider the foregoing to be meaningless. Others will see clearly the benefits to economic productivity that will come from having the direction of economic affairs rooted in the free spiritual life. If this preliminary condition is fulfilled, the present interest in capital and its increase merely for the sake of profits would be replaced by a practical interest in producing something and getting work done. The socialistic-minded thinkers of today are struggling to get the means of production under the control of society. What is legitimate in their aims can only be achieved if this control is exercised by the free spiritual sphere of society. In that way, economic compulsion, which goes out from the capitalist and which is felt as something unworthy of human beings, will be made impossible. Such compulsion arises when the capitalist acts out of the forces of economic life. At the same time, the crippling of men's individual abilities, which results when these abilities are governed by the political state, will not arise. Earnings on everything done through capital and individual ability must result, like the results of all other spiritual work, from the free initiative of the doer and the free appreciation of those who wish the work done. A man himself must estimate what these earnings must be, taking into consideration preliminary training, incidental expenses, etc. Whether he finds his claims gratified or not depends on the appreciation his services meet with. Social arrangements on such lines will lay the basis for a really free contractual relationship between the employer, work director, and the work doer. It will rest not on barter of commodities or money for labor, but on an agreement as to the share due to each of the two joint producers of the commodity. The sort of service rendered to the body social on the basis of capital depends from its very nature on the way in which individual human capacities reach into the social organism. Nothing but the free spiritual life can give men's abilities the impulse they need for their development. Even in a society where this development is tied up with a political state administration or with the forces of economic life, real productivity in things requiring the expenditure of capital depends on the extent to which free individual capacities can force their way through the hindrances imposed on them. Under such conditions, however, the development is not a healthy one. This free development of individual ability, using capital as a basis, is not what has brought about the commodity status of human labor power, but rather is it the shackling of labor power by the political state or by the circuit of economic processes. Recognition of this fact is a necessary preliminary to everything that has to be done by way of social organization. For the superstition has grown up that the measures needed for the health of society must come from either the state or the economy. If we go any farther along the road on which this superstition has led us, we shall be setting up all sorts of institutions that will make oppressive conditions increasingly worse, instead of leading man toward the goal he is striving for. People learned to think about capitalism at a time when it had induced a disease in the body social. They experience the disease and see that something must be done about it. But they must see more, namely that the disease originates in the absorption into the economic circuit of the forces at work in capital. If one wants to work in the direction called for by the forces of human evolution, one must not be deluded into considering as, quote, impractical idealism, unquote, the idea that the management of capital should be in the sphere of the free spiritual life. At present, people are little inclined to connect the idea that is to lead capitalism in a healthy direction with the free spiritual life. Rather, they connect it with something in the circuit of the economic life. They see how production has led to a large-scale industry, and this in turn to the present form of capitalism. Now they propose to replace this by a system of syndicates that will work to meet the wants of the producers themselves. Since, of course, industry must retain all the modern means of production, the various industrial concerns are to be united in one big syndicate. Here, they think, everyone will be producing to meet the orders of the community, and the community cannot be an exploiter because it would simply be exploiting itself. Since they must link on to something that already exists, they turn their attention to the modern state with the idea of converting it into a comprehensive syndicate. What they leave out of account is that the bigger the syndicate, the less likelihood of its being able to do what they expect of it, unless individual ability finds its place in the organism of the syndicate in the manner and the form already described. The community control of labor cannot lead to healing of the social organism. People are unwilling to look without bias at the idea of the spiritual life taking an active part in the social organism because they are used to thinking of it as the opposite pole from everything material and practical. Many will find something grotesque in the view presented here, namely, that a part of the spiritual life should manifest itself in the activity of capital in the economic life. It is conceivable that, on this point, members of what have been up to now the ruling classes may find themselves in agreement with socialistic thinkers. To see what this supposed absurdity means for the health of the body social requires that we examine certain present-day currents of thought. These, springing from impulses in the soul, are quite honest in their fashion, but they check the development of any really social way of thinking wherever they find entrance. These thought currents tend, more or less unconsciously, away from everything that gives energy and driving power to inner experience. They aim at a world conception, an inner life, that strives for scientific knowledge as an island in the general sea of existence. One finds people who think it, quote, distinguished, unquote, to sit in cloud castles, meditating abstractly on all sorts of ethical and religious problems, such things as virtue and how best to acquire it, how to find an, quote, inner significance, unquote, for one's life, etc. One sees how impossible it is to build a bridge between what these people call good and everything that is going on in the outer world. There, in men's everyday surroundings, we see what is happening with the manipulation of capital, the payment of labor, the consumption, production, and circulation of commodities, the system of credit, of banking, and the stock exchange. One can see two main streams running side by side even in people's very habits of thought. One of them remains aloft, as it were, in divine spiritual heights, and has no desire to build a bridge from the spiritual impulses to life's ordinary activities. The other stream runs on, void of thought, in the everyday world. But life is a single whole. It cannot thrive unless the forces that dwell in all ethical and religious life bring driving power to the commonplace, everyday things of life. That life that some people may think a bit beneath them. For if people neglect building a bridge between the two regions of life, then not only their religious and moral life, but also their social thinking, degenerates into mere wordy sentiment, far removed from everyday life, reality. This reality, then, has its revenge. Out of a sort of spiritual impulse, man goes on striving after every imaginable ideal and everything he calls good, but to those instincts that underlie the ordinary daily needs of life, the ones that need an economic system for their satisfaction, he devotes himself minus his spirit. He knows no pathway between the two realms. And so everyday life gets a form that is not even supposed to have any connection with those ethical impulses. Then the ordinary things of every day are avenged, for the ethical religious life turns to a living lie in men's hearts, because without this being noticed, it is being separated from all direct contact with life. How many people there are today who, out of a certain ethical or religious quality of mind, have the will to live on a right footing with their fellow men? They really want to deal with others only in the best way imaginable, but they cannot lay hold of any social conception that expresses itself in practical habits of life. It is people like these who, at this epoch-making moment, when social questions have become so urgent, are actually blocking the road to a true practice of life. They see themselves as practical, while they are in fact visionary obstructionists. One can hear them making speeches like this, quote, "What is really needed is for people to rise above all this materialism, this external material life that drove us into the disaster of the Great War and into all this misery. People must turn to a spiritual conception of life," unquote. To illustrate man's path to spirituality, they harp on great men of the past who were venerated for their spiritual way of thinking. When one tries to bring the talk around to the thing the spirit has to do for practical life, the creation of daily bread, one is reminded that the first thing, after all, is to bring people again to acknowledge the spirit. At this moment, however, the urgent thing is to employ the powers of the spiritual life to discover the right principles of social health. For this, it is not enough that men make a hobby of the spirit. Everyday existence needs to be brought into line with the spirit. It was this taste for turning spiritual life into bypaths that led the classes that have been ruling up to now to favor the social conditions that ended in the present state of affairs. In contemporary society, the management of capital for the production of commodities and the ownership of the means of production, thus also of capital, are tightly bound together. Yet the effects in the social system of these two relationships between man and capital, management and ownership, are quite different. The control, the management of capital by individual ability is, when suitably applied, a means to everybody's interest of enriching the body social with goods. Whatever a person's position in life, it is to his interest that there should be no waste of those individual abilities that flow from the springs of human nature. Through them are created goods that are of use to the life of man. Yet, these abilities are never developed unless the people endowed with them have free initiative in their exercise. Any check to the free flow from these sources means a certain measure of loss to human welfare. but capital is the means for making these abilities available for wide spheres of social life. To administer the total amount of capital in such a way that specially gifted individuals or qualified groups can get the use of it, to apply it as their particular initiative prompts them, must be to the true interests of everybody in a community. Everybody, brain worker or laborer, must say, if he steers clear of prejudice and consults his own interests, quote, I not only wish an adequate number of persons or groups of people to have absolutely independent use of capital, but I should also like them to have access to it on their own initiative. For they themselves are the best judges of how their particular abilities can make capital a means of producing what is useful to the body social. Unquote. It does not fall within the scope of this work to describe how, as individual human abilities came to play a part in the body social, private property grew up out of other forms of ownership. Up to the present day, this form of ownership has, under the influence of the division of labor, gone on developing within the body social. It is with present conditions and the necessary next stage of their evolution that we are concerned here. In whatever way private property arose, by the exercise of power, conquest, etc., it is an outcome of the social creativeness that is associated with individual human ability. Yet, socialists today, with their thoughts bent on social reconstruction, hold the theory that the only way to get rid of what is oppressive in private ownership is to turn to communal ownership. They put the question this way. How can private possession of the means of production be prevented so that its oppressive effect on the unpropertied masses may cease? In putting the question this way, they overlook the fact that the social organism is something that is constantly developing, growing. About a growing organism, one cannot ask what is the best arrangement for preserving it in the state one regards as suitable for it. One can think in that way about something that goes on essentially unchanged from the point at which it was when it started. That will not do for the body social. Its life is a continual changing of each thing that arises in it. To fix on some form as the best and expect it to remain in that form is to undermine the very conditions of its life. One of the requisites for the life of the social organism is that, as already stated, those who can serve the community through their individual abilities should not lose the possibility of doing so on their own initiative. This includes independent use of the means of production. I shall not use the common argument that the prospect of the gains associated with the means of production is needed as a stimulus. The concept presented here of a progressive evolution in social conditions must lead to the expectation that this kind of stimulus to social activity can drop away. This result can come through the setting free of the spiritual life from the political and the economic social entities. The liberated spiritual life will of itself inevitably evolve a social sense, and out of this will arise stimuli of quite a different sort from those that lie in the hope of economic advantage. The question here is not so much concerned with the kind of impulse that makes men like private ownership of the means of production. We must ask whether the independent use of them, or use directed by the community, meets the requirements for the life of the social organism. We cannot here draw conclusions from conditions supposed to be found in primitive communities, but only from what corresponds to man's present stage of development. At this present stage, the fruitful exercise of individual ability through the use of capital cannot make itself felt in the economic life unless the access to it is free and independent. Where there is to be fruitful production, this access must be possible, not because it will bring advantage to an individual or group, but because, directed by a social sense, such use of the means of production is the best way of serving the community. Man is connected with what he, alone or with others, is producing, as he is connected with the skill of his own arms and legs. Interfering with this free access to the means of production is like crippling the free exercise of bodily skill. Private ownership is simply the means of providing this free and independent use of the means of production. As far as the body social is concerned, the only significance of ownership is that the owner has the right to use his property on his own free initiative. One sees, joined together in the life of society, two things of quite different significance for the social organism. There is the free access to the capital, basis of social production, and on the other hand, there is the rights relationship that arises between the user and other people. This comes up through the fact that his right of use keeps these other people from any free activity on the basis of this same capital. It is not the original free use that leads to social harm, but the continuance of the right of use after the conditions that tied it to his individual abilities have come to an end. One who sees the social organism as something growing, developing, cannot fail to understand what is meant. For what is living, there exists no fruitful arrangement by which a finished process does not later in its turn become detrimental. The question is entirely one of intervening at the right moment, when what had been opportune and helpful is beginning to become detrimental. There must be the possibility of the free access of individual capacities to the capital basis. It must also be possible to change the right of ownership connected with it in the moment that this right starts to change into a means for the unjust acquisition of power. There is an institution introduced in our times that meets this social requirement, but only partially, since it applies simply to, quote, spiritual property, unquote. I refer to copyrights. Such property, after the author is dead, passes after a certain length of time into the ownership of the community for free use. Here we have an underlying conception that accords with the actual nature of life in a human society. Closely as the production of a purely spiritual, cultural possession is bound up with the gifts and capacities of the individual, it is at the same time a result of the common social life, and must pass at the right moment back into this. It is just the same with other property. By the aid of his property, the individual produces for the service of the community, but this is only possible in cooperation with the community. Accordingly, the right to the use of a piece of property cannot be exercised separately from the interests of the community. The problem is not how to abolish ownership of the capital basis, but how this ownership can be so administered that it serves the community in the best way possible. The way to do this can be found in the threefold order of society. The people united in the social organism act as a totality through the rights state. The exercise of individual abilities comes under the spiritual organization. Everything in the body social, viewed from a sense of actualities and not from subjective opinions and theories, indicates the necessity for the threefolding of this organism. This is especially clear as regards the relation of individual abilities to the capital basis and its ownership. The rights state will not interfere with the formation and control of private property in capital so long as the connection of this with personal ability remains such that the private control represents a service to the whole social organism. Moreover, it will remain a rights state in its dealings with private property. It will never itself take over the ownership of private property. It will only bring it about that the right of use is transferred at the proper moment to a person or group of persons who are, again, capable of establishing a relation to this ownership that is based on individual abilities. This will benefit the body social in two quite different ways. The democratic foundation of the rights state, being concerned with what touches all men equally, there will be a watch kept to see that property rights do not in the course of time become property wrongs. The other benefit is that the individual human abilities into whose control the property is given, since the state itself does not administer property, are thus furnished the means of fructifying the whole social organism. Under an organization of this sort, property rights, or their exercise, can be left attached to a personality for as long as seems opportune. One can conceive the representatives of the rights state as laying down quite different laws at different times concerning the transfer of property from one person or group to another. Today, when all private property has come to be regarded with great distrust, the proposal is to convert it wholesale into community property. If people go far on this road, they will see that they are strangling the life of the social organism, and, taught by experience, they will then pursue a different path. It would surely be better now, at this time, to take measures that would secure social health on the lines here indicated. So long as an individual, alone or with a group, continues to carry on that productive activity that first procured him a capital basis to work on, he shall retain the right to use accumulations arising as gains on the primary capital, if these are used for the productive extension of the business. As soon as this particular personality ceases to control the work of production, this accumulation of capital shall pass on to another person or group to carry on the same kind of business or some other branch of productive industry useful to the whole community. Capital accumulating from a productive industry that is not used for its extension must, from the beginning, go the same way. Nothing shall count as the personal property of the individual directing the business except what he gets in accordance with the claims for compensation that he made when he first took over the business. These were claims he felt able to make on the ground of his personal abilities, and that appear justified by the fact that he was able to impress people sufficiently with his abilities for them to trust him with capital. If the capital has been increased through his personal exertions, then a portion of this increment will also pass into his private ownership, this addition to his original earnings representing a percentage of the increase of the capital. Where the original person controlling an industry is unable or unwilling to continue in charge, the capital used to start it will either pass over to the new person in charge, along with all its incumbent obligations, or will revert to the original owners, according to their decision. In such an arrangement, one is dealing with transfers of a right. The legal regulation of the terms of such transfers is a matter for the rights state. It will also be up to the rights state to see that these transfers are carried out and to administer them. It is conceivable that details of such regulations for transfers of a right will vary greatly in accordance with how the common sense of right, the rights consciousness, varies in its view of what is right. No mode of conception, which, like this one, aims at being true to life, will ever attempt to do more than indicate the general direction that such regulation should take. Keeping to this direction and using one's understanding, one will always discover the appropriate thing to do in any concrete instance. One must always judge the right course according to the circumstances and from the spirit of the thing. For instance, it is obvious that the rights state must never use its control of rights transfers to get any capital into its own hands. Its only business will be to see that the transfer is made to a person or group whose individual abilities seem to warrant it. This way of thinking also presupposes, as a general rule, that anyone who has to undertake such a transfer of capital from his own hands will be free to select his successor in the use of it. He will be free to select a person or group, or else transfer the right of use to a corporate body of the spiritual organization. For anyone who has given practical services to society through his management of capital is likely, from native ability and social sense, to be able to judge what should be done with the capital afterward. It will be more to the advantage of the community to abide by what he decides than to leave the decisions to people who have no direct connection with the matter. Some settlement of this kind will be required in the case of capital accumulations over a certain amount, acquired through use of the means of production, and land also comes under this category. The exception is where the gains become private property by means of the original agreement for the exercise of the individual's capacities. In the latter case, what is so earned, as well as all savings coming from the results of a person's own work, will remain in the earner's private possession until his death, or in the possession of his descendants until some later date. Until this time, these savings will draw interest from any person who gets them to create means of production. The amount of interest will be the outcome of the general rights consciousness and will be fixed by the rights state. In a social order based on the principles described here, it will be possible to draw a complete distinction between yields resulting from the employment of the means of production and sums accumulated through the earnings of personal labor, spiritual or physical. It accords with the common sense of right, as well as being to the general social interest, that these two things should be kept distinct. What a person saves and places at the disposal of a productive industry is a service in the interests of all, since this makes it possible for personal ability to direct production. Where, after the rightful interest has been deducted, there is an increase that arises out of the means of production, that increase is due to the collective working of the whole social organism. This must accordingly flow back into it again in the way described above. All that the rights state will have to do is to pass a resolution that these capital accumulations are to be transferred in the way prescribed. The state will not decide which material or spiritual branch of production is to have the disposal of capital so transferred, or of capital savings. For it to do so would lead to the tyranny of the state over spiritual and material production. But anyone who does not want to select his successor to exercise the right of disposal over capital he has created may appoint a corporate body of the spiritual sphere to do this. Property acquired through saving, together with the interest on it, will also pass at the earner's death, or a little while later, to some person or group actively engaged in spiritual or material production. But it must only go to a producer. If it went to an unproductive person, it would simply become private income. The choice will be made by the earner in his last will. Here, again, no person or group can be chosen direct. It will be a question of transferring the right of disposal to a corporation of the spiritual organism. Only when a person himself makes no disposition of his savings will the rights state act on his behalf and require the spiritual organization to dispose of them. In a society ordered on these lines, due regard is paid both to the free initiative of the individual and to the social interests of the general community. In fact, these are fully met through the setting free of private initiative to serve them. Whoever has to give his labor over to the direction of another person can know that under such an order of things, their joint work will bear fruit to the best advantage of the community, and therefore to that of the worker himself. This is the end of the first half of Chapter 3 of the Threefold Social Order. There will be another part to this same chapter. If anybody has this edition, I'm on page 58 at the beginning of the first new paragraph.